Hello, and welcome to Words and Pictures, the show all about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we have quite a show for you today. We are talking about virtual reality, as well as 3D effects in comics and illustration. Yeah, basically everything that kind of breaks the two-dimensional plane of the page and the screen. And joining us live in the studio is Jeremy Rutstein. Jeremy is gearing up to unveil a big installation at the Academy Theater here in Portland. It's called House of Shadow Silence, and it combines century-old artistic movements such as Dada with contemporary digital projection technology. Jeremy, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And also with us is author, illustrator, and comics artist David Chelsea. His new book, just out from Watson Guptill, is Perspective in Action: Creative Exercises for Depicting Spatial Representation from the Renaissance to the Digital Age. David, it's great to have you back.
Ooh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Jeremy, let's start with you. I'm very interested in hearing about this project. You have some samples up online about how this is going to look, but basically you're turning a traditional movie theater with its screen and its just regular walls and ceiling into something that's more of an immersive experience. Mm-hmm. And this was actually an idea that was come up that was proposed almost a century ago by a fellow named Frederick
Kiesler.
Yes.
He's the architect and artist.
So give us a little bit more background here.
The project is called House of Shadow Silence, and it transports people to or visitors to a historic theater from the 1920s. That theater was called the Film Guild Cinema, and what attracted me to the cinema is that Kiesler, when he first designed it, wanted to make an immersive viewing experience, and he had this bold idea, which was that he wouldn't just project onto the main screen, but you'd also project onto the walls, the left and right walls, and onto the ceiling. He also had these groundbreaking ideas about creating this kind of like immersive light installation that would also which send rays of light throughout the space as people were watching film. So this would kind of like emphasize the drama of the scenes that was going on. So the theater it opened in 1929, but they ran out of money, so they didn't add all of the auxiliary projectors.
And this was the Film Arts Guild Theater in New York, is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it was kind of like your typical repertory cinema. It showed avant-garde films, exported films from Germany and the Soviet Union. So you'd kind of go to this place to go see like the Man with the Movie Camera or Eisenstein or something like that.
Right. It's interesting that actually back in the silent era, there was a lot more avant-garde movements in film. You had folks such as Dali and Hans Richter and these folks from the Surrealist and Dada periods doing a lot of experimental material that ended up on the screen. And some of that died out when Hollywood adopted sound and became a lot more professional in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting reflection.
And one of your, so what your project is doing is it's making the theater virtually into the space that Kiesler had in mind. And you're using one of the Dada art, and we mentioned Hans Richter. You're using one of his abstract animations as a jumping off point.
Sure. In my research for the project, I came across actually on eBay of all places, the original film program from opening weekend in 1929. It was a few thousand dollars, so I couldn't add it to my collection, unfortunately. But on it, it had a story of the theater, which was really interesting. And it showed the films that were displayed on opening night. And one of them was, I can't remember the name of the film, it was a narrative film in which Hans Richter had done, and I quote, abstract movements for. So you can imagine it kind of disappearing, like having moments that were not of this world, I guess. And so I couldn't track down the actual film itself, but I decided that I'd kind of sample or take loops of Richter's films and play them in the theater, project them onto the walls of the theater as Kiesler kind of imagined there being projections onto the walls.
Now, what you're using is virtual reality headsets, which is, you know, it's actually not a new thing. It's interesting to me to see virtual reality making a comeback because I can remember back in the 1990s, I would visit the University of Washington in Seattle. Mm-hmm. They had an impressive VR lab set up there. That all kind of faded away.
Yeah, it didn't survive. It didn't make it. It was too expensive. It really only existed in university labs and other research institutions. So it didn't. I mean, I guess it had some moments where, like, you know, you'd go to the movie theater and there'd be like a $5 experience that you'd walk into the space and you'd experiment with it. But it didn't make it into mass acceptance. And nowadays it's a lot more affordable for people to buy it and use it in the comforts of their own home.
Right. Just in the last couple of years, you see the headsets cropping up. And so that's what you're offering. The experience you're offering is in the Academy Theater, which is in an old theater in the Montevilla section of Portland. You're taking over one or two of the cinemas there, and you're offering headsets for folks who come in. And
it'll be one of the cinemas. People will come in groups of six at a time, and they'll put on headsets and they'll find themselves inside of the Film Guild Theater. And looking around, they'll see the architecture of the original theater. And moments later, they'll kind of start floating into the air and through the actual. Through the virtual representation of the Film Guild Cinema.
Well, we don't have a virtual visual experience right now, but we do have a clip from some of the soundtrack that people will be hearing if they show up. I think it's August 5th and 6th, is
it's
that right?
It's the 4th and 5th.
4th and 5th of August. And let's listen to a little bit of that soundtrack right now. That composition, it kind of hews back to some of the kind of early 20th century avant-garde music. Is that a more recent composition?
It is. I'm actually, I'm using samples, some recorded samples from a man named Zamenik, who did a lot of the silent music composition of the time. I'm actually working with another sound artist named Chris Carlson, and he's taking those sounds and using a technique called granular synthesis, which kind of like stretches out little moments, little tiny samples of sound into much kind of longer, dronier moments. So the idea is to create a more haunting soundtrack that sort of has the feeling of the time of the 1920s and silent film composition.
Well, it's interesting to see the technology catching up with some of the ideas. Kind of reminds me of Leonardo da Vinci's idea of the helicopter, his sketches that were well ahead of their time. You see now, even without a VR headset, the Oregon Symphony had a recent show featuring Rose Bond, who's a friend of the show here, and she came on to talk about this projection mapping project that she did with some of her students, where along with a performance of Tarangalila, there was animation that went along with the music, and it wasn't just on the front, it was all over the walls and ceiling, much like your installation.
Yeah, there's some real parallels there. I was sad to miss it, but I saw some of the wonderful documentation that she shared of that project online.
So for folks who have never put on a VR headset, tell us about what they could expect if they go into a virtual reality installation like the one that you're planning at the Academy.
So I guess VR, I would say the VR is the ultimate technological illusion. And when you put this headset on, you really see the world as you kind of experience it with your own eyes. Your field of view is of course, slightly smaller, and there's a little bit of pixelation. It doesn't, show you the amount of detail that you can see with your eyes, but you really have this real sense of space. And I'm also working with sound in a spatial way, and that helps to create a real believable idea of space. So it's not just the image, but also the sound that helps VR become a really successful and believable medium.
So with the headset on, the viewer has one screen for each eye and obviously one headset for each ear. So, but the way that you can really plot out the sound, it goes beyond traditional stereo.
That's right. Yeah, you There's specific algorithms that VR headset manufacturers like Oculus are releasing that allows you to mix sound spatially. So you could, with each, as a programmer, I can indicate the position of that sound, and it automatically calculates how loud that sound should be based on my distance from that sound.
So you can actually move around the space, and maybe you'll see a musician playing a violin, for mm-hmm. example. And as you move around that musician, the sound will reflect where you are in relation to that musician.
Exactly. Not just as you move around, but you can actually like tilt your head to the left or the right. And then actually, like, if there are multiple sounds filling up the space, you're actually kind of like the mixer, changing the way that all the sound is coming together. It could be a really beautiful moment.
Now, how do you, as an artist, plot out the images so that they do come into this, they do seem to pass by you on all sides, on the, like you said, on the walls and the ceiling of the theater as you're moving around the space?
So one of the things that I like to do in the artwork that I make is guide people's perspectives through spaces, almost give them the idea that they're flying. So the spaces, the shapes kind of are almost still. They're sort of moving, you know, up and down, left and right, getting larger, getting smaller, kind of like in Richter's films. But I kind of set the position that the perspective algorithmically that the viewer has. So even though they're not physically moving, it's like their head is moving through the space. And so everything moves in relation to where they are in that virtual space.
Well, it actually sounds very, and this is why we have you both on the show today, sounds very similar to what David Chelsea has laid out in his new book, Perspective in Action. Well, we will come back in just a moment and we'll talk some more with Jeremy Rotstein and David Chelsea. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm live in the studio today talking about virtual reality as well as 3D effects in comics and illustration. Jeremy Rotstein's new project is called House of Shadow Silence. It'll be recreating a 20s cinema at the Academy Theater in Portland. And David Chelsea is joining us once again with his new book from Watson Guptill. We'll be back in just one moment. We are back on Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and we're talking today about getting past the two dimensions of the picture plane, of the page and the screen. And my guests are Jeremy Rotstein. He's doing a project called House of Shadow Silence, which is a virtual reality project at the Academy Theater in Portland. And David Chelsea is joining us once again. His new book, just out from Watson Guptill, is Perspective in Action, Creative Exercises for Depicting Spatial Representation from the Renaissance to the Digital Age. David, that's quite a mouthful.
Yes, it is. And I haven't quite memorized it, but you did a very good job of speaking it without tripping.
Well, you know, David, you're actually the second ever guest on Words and Pictures back in, 2004 now, I think. And your original book on perspective, you've done three of them now, is called Perspective for Artists. That was published in 1997. And you were much more of a traditional artist back then, working with analog grid paper and such. The new book is much more about working with digital tools. What do you credit your new technological prowess to? I'm gonna guess your two teenage children.
Partly my two teenage children, but also just my desire to explore and expand my knowledge. And I'm not that old, Karat. I have, you know, just the CSX version or the CS6 version of Photoshop.
Well, you don't have to pay a monthly fee then.
Yes, the last one you don't have to pay a monthly fee for. I have a, you know, a Cintiq from 2012, and I've got, you know, three versions ago of Lightwave. But I guess I'm, you know, I guess a lot of artists of my generation haven't really gotten past the analog. So I guess that makes me the exception.
Well, for those Luddite artists who don't go for the Creative Suite and would rather just use the grid paper, you do have that set up in here where you can, where you lay out step by step how a person can do all of these great anamorphic, and that's a great $6 word, by the way, anamorphic.
Yes.
I think of it generally as the lens that you put on a projection, a film projector to make the screen wide. But in this case, it's the sort of technology you can use to make a chalk drawing on a sidewalk that fools the eye, the trompe l'oeil, as people walk by on the sidewalk. And there's a trick to that. Tell us about how you can make the illusion of perspective where there really is none, where you put it on a two-dimensional plane and turn it into a three-dimensional trick of the eye.
Well, it's all perspective is an illusion. It's all an effort for you to simulate the effect that you would have looking through a window, but on a flat surface. And, you know, these rules have been known about since the Renaissance. It's just that not very many artists apply them strictly. But if you're going to do something like a chalk drawing, which resolves into a perspective image, you know, even though it's painted, you know, on the sidewalk, you do have to apply perspective strictly. And it totally does not work if you deviate from the spot that you're supposed to view it from.
Right, and there's other tricks that are here in the book, Perspective in Action. There's an old trick that goes back to the Victorian age where you take a rolled up reflective surface like a cylinder, and you place that on a page, and something that just looked like a complete mess would resolve into a face or a figure, something like that. And that's something, again, something you can do with software very easily now, but you can also just do that freehanding it.
Yeah, it's just a matter of distorting the image, and it's the kind of thing that might be familiar from the warp tool in Photoshop, but it's something that artists had to figure out how to do themselves, you know, back when those devices were popular.
And if anybody's ever done a mural, like done a school mural with a bunch of people, it's a similar principle to scaling up from a piece of paper, a small version, to a full wall. You will make a grid, and you will copy the material that's in the small grid onto the large grid, so that it so that you don't lose where you are in the entirety of the piece.
Yeah. And if you make distortions in the grid and you follow those distortions when you copy the smaller image, then you can do all kinds of very interesting transformations. A lot of the kind of curvilinear perspective methods that I use have direct analogs in map projection.
Right, projection mapping, which is the big thing out here. We were talking about Rose Bond's thing earlier. And, you know, in fact, you used to do, before the software made it really easy, you used to make your own globes that tilted perspective. And you used to do that just with a camera and a whole bunch of pictures all sewn together.
Yes. Well, if you think about it, people used to do this, and I guess they still can, which is people used to stand in one spot and make a panorama by moving the camera across the horizon and then creating a kind of a piecemeal panorama by just taking all the resulting prints and laying them in a line. And the way that you can extend that further is think about creating a piecemeal panorama that would be a vertical line extending perpendicularly above and below the horizon. And then if you take it a little further, you can think of creating a kind of polyhedron of all of these pictures. So I didn't actually do this, but it was very easy to create just sort of a series of patterns in involving those photographs that I could kind of transfer to the spherical paint or the spherical painting surface.
And if you see a map of the world that's what is it, the Mercator projection, it distorts the world in a way that a globe does not. So in the same way, if you take a whole bunch of pictures of the area that you're standing in, and you put them all together, there will be some distortion. And it's just kind of fun to see the way that that works. And this is a trick, like you said, that started in the Renaissance. There's some history in this book, Perspective and Action, about when art really changed in the Western world from these flat planes, from these sort of Turkish miniatures and these Byzantine kind of murals, to a place where there was the illusion of perspective. There is a movie called Tim's Vermeer, where a fellow who had a lot of tech money pretty much spent a year recreating a Vermeer with the technology of the time, such as camera obscuras and mirrors and all of these ways that he could basically paint a photograph like they did in the 16th, 17th centuries.
Yeah. And I include a breakdown of, well, he doesn't go into detail in the film, but I include a breakdown of what I take to be his method, you know, without all the bells and whistles. If you want to build a Renaissance room and you know, create a period spinet and period tiles and wallpaper, that's fine. You can do it with your own room, and I just include basically the optical setup, using a small mirror, a concave mirror, and a magnifying glass.
And for people with carpentry skills, there are many projects like that in this book.
Yes.
You have the Cabinet of Wonders, and you have the Ames Room.
Yes. Now, the Ames Room, you might be familiar with it if you ever go to OMSI, or if you ever go to a science museum, or it turns up a lot in music videos. But this is a room that is constructed in such a way that it appears that a figure at one corner is twice the size of another, and you know, like two identically sized humans. One will appear huge, one will appear tiny, and that's because the seemingly tinier human is actually twice as far from you, and the room is constructed in a kind of a skewed way, and none of the walls or floor or ceiling are actually rectangular.
And some of the other worlds you're showing people how to create are 3D comics, for example, and doing that with cameras and software, and also the Magic Eye pictures, the old Magic Eye pictures that will show a... And now, speaking as somebody who does not have full binocular vision, I never saw these things, but... these are the sort of colorful, psychedelic, abstract-looking posters that when you kind of cross your eye in a certain way, the image will... there's a 3D image that will sort of appear out of them.
Yes, yes. I don't have anything like that.
You don't have any? Okay.
You mean those random dot stereograms?
Yeah, you've got.
I've got something similar to that.
It is similar.
But those random dot stereograms are kind of a step beyond.
Okay.
And those are interesting. I would love to do them, but basically they're sculpture. As far as I can tell, you create a CG object, and then you apply some kind of random stereo map so that when you cross your eyes or the opposite of crossing your eyes, it will resolve into something sculptural that has actually no kind of modeling or lighting to it at all.
Now, have you ever thought of moving into the realm of virtual reality?
I've thought of it. Actually, I've seen a little bit of virtual reality, and it seems to me that the kind of method that I use for the spherical paintings is very applicable. And I've actually done, I've put some of my spherical paintings online in immersive form, so that you can you take your mouse and scroll through them and look around, look up, look down. And that would be, I think, applicable. But I don't know enough about virtual reality. Maybe I can pick Jeremy's brain about it.
That might be the fourth book in the Perspective series.
Actually, Jeremy, the raw material, the imagery that you're using for your virtual reality, is it mapped as an equirectangular projection?
No. What happens actually when I work on a VR project is I render each scene twice. I have to render it once for each eye, and each eye, what the headset provides you with, is the distance between the two eyes,
which is usually about 2 inches, right?
Uh huh. And the angle as well. So it draws the same scene twice, and so you get a 16:9 screen with two different scenes, or the same scene twice. And because you have the headset so close to your eyes, you see one side from one perspective and the other side from another perspective. There's multiple ways. I guess.
But is it immersive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is exactly as you would see.
So you have an overall image, right? So is that like one of those panoramas, like an immersive panorama that you'd see online, like on Flickr?
It's kind of like seeing there are multiple ways to render virtual reality, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the way that I'm doing it is more of like a stereoscopic image, if that makes sense. A left and right image, a left and right view of the scene.
Mm-hmm. But is it an overall panorama?
You only render a small section at a time. So wherever the viewer is looking, that's what is displayed on screen. So as they turn their head, they see different sections.
Now here's a question I have. So you're putting, you're putting like six viewers into the scene at once, and nothing that they're perceiving is actually in the room. Is that correct?
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. But they'll isn't be on that, chairs.
Isn't there a danger that they're going to bump into
each other? No, they're going to be seated the whole time. It's kind of like the same.
Actually, do they ever move from square one? Meaning, is their viewpoint fixed? I know that they can.
No, so one of the, even though they're seating, because I do this trick, which I actually float their perspective through the space, they feel like they're, it's almost as if their chairs are floating along with them. And I draw their chair a little bit lower than what they can see. So if they look down, they don't see their bodies, but they see their chairs.
Okay.
So there is an animated perspective that goes through the cinema.
But
they're not moving.
They're not able to move through the space.
Exactly. They're not able to walk around at all.
Okay.
Yeah. Now you're going to be on hand to answer more questions on the 4th and 5th of August at the Academy Theater. Is that right?
I will definitely be there. Yeah.
So tell us again about how to find out more about House of Shadow Silence, the installation.
So there is a Facebook page, excuse me. And if you just look on Facebook for House of Shadow Silence, you will find it. There's also information on my website, which is www.mantissa.ca.
And David Chelsea's new book is Perspective in Action, Creative Exercises for Depicting Spatial Representation from the Renaissance to the Digital Age. And David, you're getting ready to take the book down to the San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes, there's going to be a screening of the documentary film I'm in, 24-hour comic. But I'm also bringing the book. I'm also bringing my other books, including books of 24-hour comics from Dark Horse.
And that's a fun movie, 24-hour comic. It was just playing in Portland. It's available on iTunes. So check it out if you'd like to see David Chelsea in all his glory.
Yeah, and you'll actually see me gathering research for one of my spherical paintings.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks to all our guests today, and thanks to our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.FM/Words and Pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @WordsAndPicture.